Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witchlit is brought to you by Thousand Bolt Press, a family-owned independent publisher established to produce the books we want to see in the world. Titles including Changing Paths by Yvonne Abreu, Conjuring the Commonplace by Lane Fuller and Corey Thomas Hutchison, and my latest book, Verona Green, can be purchased directly from thousandvoltpress.com or wherever you buy books. Kata Kiss's first job was playing a vampire baby in a student film, sealing her fate as a goth child for life. After a variety pack of jobs and apartments, she is currently settled in Northern California. She cohabitates with her two adorable demon babies masquerading as cats and her high school romance, which never ended. When not writing, she can usually be found reading. Love in the Liner Notes is her debut novel. Kata Kiss, welcome to Witchlit.
Yay, thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, I'm excited to have you here. And thanks to the Witchlit cheerleader, Marcus, for telling you should say yes, definitely yes. Get in contact.
Yes, Marcus is the best. I love him.
I hope he listens and he hears that. Oh, and I will say for listeners, Kata and I are both recuperating from illness. So this might not be the most beautiful our voices could be.
Yeah, mine's definitely a little lower than usual.
Yeah. So I'm super excited to talk about your book, but our first question for everybody on the show, and I think this is, I'm interested to hear what you have to say, you know, especially with like publishing in the state it's in and just, you know, general, like the general media state right now, why write? Why still write books?
I guess, you know, I was thinking about this because I was listening to your Fairies podcast episodes and I was like, oh, she always asks this question. And I think my answer is kind of, why not? I mean, like, I feel shitty if I don't write. And so if it brings me joy, and then maybe it brings someone else joy if I share the story with them, you know, that's my reasoning. And it's kind of a privileged thing because I self-published this, and so I had the money to do this, which I'm very grateful for. But I think, I don't know, stories are so important and they help us relate to each other. And I don't think that's something that like AI can replicate. And I don't think that's something that, I mean, there's this like spark that publishers and people are always looking for. And I think that's just something that you pull out of yourself and share with people. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. No, totally. Totally makes sense. And I think, you know, when I was reading your acknowledgments in the book and you talk about, you know, you got to the, you know, your beta readers and getting to the query point. Mm-hmm. And so I did want to ask you about why the decision to self-publish. I mean, obviously I also self-published and started my own publishing house. So it's, you know, it's not a judgment thing so much as it just, why make that decision? Cause it is a harder road, I think, and more expensive, frankly.
Yeah. This is the second book I queried. And I got like a lot of rejections on both books that I queried. And the first one, you know, it's a drawer book. I don't think it's going to see the light of day, but this one I felt was really strong. And I had a lot of love for it from the people who had read it. And I was like, you know, I have a full-time job. I can finance this late, maybe. And I'm looking at the sort of the way the traditional publishing is eating itself right now. And I was like, you know, maybe it's better if I do this myself and I can take this as slow as I want to and try to just make it the best I can. And I think it, like, you know, I learned a lot on the way. Mm-hmm. It's definitely harder than I would have expected in ways that I didn't expect. But I feel like I can put out a pretty good product. And so, you know, why not try to do it myself?
So what did you find the most challenging in doing that?
Marketing sucks.
Yes.
just like some of the technical things I would get in my head about, or like Barnes & Noble's platform, trying to get them to accept my cover size and formatting, like I was literally just like screaming at the computer because it was just so, and I don't think I'm going to go through Barnes & Noble for the next book, let me say.
Yeah.
But I have Ingram, so they can do it for me.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just technical stuff and marketing. And then just, yeah, I did the cover too. So it's like doing the different formatting because I did it through Canva and I'm not a designer. But there are all these learning curves that I came across with all that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was thinking about covers for romance, and right now we're in such a weird place because they've really moved to like what used to be like the rom-com, you know, illustrated cover. Mm-hmm. Is now the cover on everything, like even erotica. And you're like, how are you supposed to tell the genres apart, like the subgenres apart? But it does make it easier to do your own cover because you don't have to have this like perfectly Photoshopped man chest kind of cover right now.
Yeah. So. I am kind of glad we moved away from the man chest because I think when I was younger, that's what kept me out of romance because I was mm-hmm. like, why am I like, I can't carry this around. There's just like so many abs on the cover.
Like do humans have that many abs?
Yeah, Apex? That seems weird. But now I think maybe it's gone too far in the other direction where it's like you have this like deeply traumatizing book and it's got like this cute little like illustrated cover on it. And you're just like, whoa, I was not expecting that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a little tough out there right now. But I guess, you know, the illustrated covers sell. And I think they're less expensive to produce in mm-hmm. a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, one of the things I'd heard from friends, especially talking to other romance writers, is that, you know, especially people who are writing books with some diversity, it's really mm-hmm. hard to find cover models in stock images.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
it's just difficult if you have an interracial couple or, you know, it's just difficult to find the right images. Yeah. So,
I've heard that too. I considered the stock image thing, but I was like, the rights on that is weird too, because mm-hmm. like if you don't get the right rights, then you could get someone could come along and be like, well, I'm suing you because you distributed this for sale, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That scared me.
No, I mean, it's a challenge. And I, you know, I, again, share the privilege of being able to do this. And my husband also worked for Ingram.
Mm.
So, and did cover design and stuff like that. So, It was a little easier to step into that pool because we had his expertise. But yeah, it's really challenging. So, a lot of challenges to it. But, you know, I think personally for me, the fun part is writing,
mm-hmm.
obviously. And then everything else is kind of the stuff you have to do. But
yeah,
for you, like where... I guess maybe, especially for folks who haven't read the book and are listening, can you do like a really brief synopsis and then maybe we can talk about the story as spoiler free as possible?
Okay. So we have two washed up guys from a boy band that has broken up years ago. And we have the girl who was best friends with one of them and has been pining after him for years. And he's finally kissed her back, except then he freaks out about it. And she and his friend have to try to sort of bring everything back together. And in the process, she falls in love with his friend, just super messy. So we got like an angsty love triangle thing going
on. Yeah. And in the beginning, I was like, oh, love triangle. I don't know. But it was so good. I was just like, oh, yeah. But the thing we talked a little bit before, but the thing I like about it is like these are really real people. Like they have some depth to them. They're complex. They have lives. They have pasts.
Mm-hmm.
But they also have this like really interesting network of friends and family, and you get all of that. So it doesn't feel like them falling in love is in a vacuum, which is like one of the things about not as well written romance novels that I don't enjoy. I mean, you just feel like, are these two stick people and we're going to make them fall in love surrounded by other stick people.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really, I don't know. That doesn't work for me, but the story deals with some pretty complex stuff. So like what were the seeds for this story? Like what were the seeds for Cassie and RK, I guess.
So I've been writing this book since college, so it went through a lot of iterations. And it sort of sparked off, the original one is very silly. It's that in high school, everybody was obsessed with the Jonas Brothers. And so I was a contrarian little hipster goth girl. And I was like, I would love it if a Jonas Brother fell in love with me. And then I rejected him. And that was like the scene for this whole series. And it's obviously gotten a lot more complex since then, because it sort of incorporated stuff that I wanted to tackle, like sex education and paganism and toxic relationships and the dark side of fame and rape culture. And so like over the years, they grew up with me. In the first iteration, they were like 19. She was in college and she was like super angry about everything. And then I sort of, at one point I went through a beta reader session and everybody hated it. And I was like, shoot, you know, it was like, it was disheartening, except one person who really loved it. And thank God for that one person, because like, I would have stopped writing this book if she hadn't loved it. But, you know, I sort of sat with it for a while and I wrote something else and I came back to it and I was like, I'm not 19 anymore. I can't write 19-year-olds and I don't think I want to. And so I aged them up and it became so much more like, there's so much more depth into it. Mm-hmm. So that there was like so much more life. He was no longer in the boy band. She was, you know, no longer this sort of aimless college student. She had a job. She had a life. She was doing something with her trauma instead of just lashing out at everyone. Mm-hmm. And so I think that complexity was just sort of baked in with the length of the process, which I'm grateful for.
Yeah.
Because it was not ready in that first iteration.
Yeah, I have only encountered one author who said that they write it, they never look at it again, and they send it to their editor. And I was like, I can't even imagine that. Like, kind of blew my mind. But this person that also publishes, like, you know, 20 books a year or something.
Oh my goodness. So, yeah.
I don't write that fast.
Me neither. I'm going to be happy if I put out one book a year.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, to me, that feels like a human pace for me. Mm-hmm. But yeah. So I guess I'm curious, like, obviously, you are a pagan practitioner. Mm-hmm. So how did you decide you wanted to work it in there? Because I think a lot of romance that has any witchcraft or pagan elements gets shunted into like paranormal. Mm-hmm. And this really isn't. I mean, I think that's kind of important to say. It's really not paranormal.
Yeah, it really isn't. And I'm sure that's going to give me a lot of trouble with marketing. But that's part of why I did it, was that in that first iteration, there was no real paganism. And then when I came back to it, I was much deeper in my pagan practice. And I was like, I never see this. And I needed to give her a way to cope. Mm-hmm. And that was how I was coping. I was working a lot of shitty corporate jobs, and I was coping by drawing sigils all over myself. And so I was like, you know, I never see this, and I would love to see it, because, you know, this is, a lot of my friends are pagan, and I want to show the world that we're not, you know, I don't know, doing CGI magic, like you were saying, like, mm-hmm. I want to show them what real magic looks like and how it can be approachable, and it can be very simple. You don't have mm-hmm. to be naked at the full moon in the middle of the woods. You can be at your desk freaking out and draw something on your wrist and feel better.
Yeah.
You know, it can be that simple. And so that was kind of the impetus for that.
Mm-hmm. So I think, obviously, this is the first book in the series and you're working mm-hmm. on book two now. So I'm curious, like, with folks who are writing a series, because mm-hmm. that's how I write to you. So do you have the whole series planned out? Are you kind of writing into the dark? Like, how do you approach this? Because obviously you've seeded us some pretty great characters for other books.
Yeah. So I have partial draft, and some of them are very partial, of all the books. And so I know sort of where everything is going. Like, I know what all the couples are. And I know to some degree, basically, I work off the character arc. So I know in some degree, someone has to get here so I can give them a happy ending, and then someone else has to get here in the next book so I can give them a happy ending. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, I kind of have a plan, but I don't have like a real outline. I have just like, okay, these two people are going to get together. These two people are going to get together. I don't know how. We're going to figure it out. And so like, I have like 3/4 of book 3 written, and I've already figured I have to like fully like tear that apart and rewrite it. And then I have like 20 pages of book 4 written. So it's a work in progress, but I'm trying to sort of circumvent second book syndrome and push it off as far as possible.
Yeah.
And that's my method.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I think it's interesting, like the, for folks who don't read romance, romance series work a little differently than other genre series in that each book is a new couple in this, usually in the same, like, I don't know, how do you describe it? Like the same situation. Like it's, usually meet almost everybody in the first book, although other characters can be introduced later that wind up being part of a couple. But I think that, like, to me, that's the big difference is, so each book is like two new characters, or I guess if you're writing, you know, polyamory, multiple new characters are the main characters. Whereas, mm-hmm. you know, most other genres, you have like your same person. So I feel like I'm a little envious of romance writers because I feel like it's a little easier to have that shorter arc. Although you get more about those characters in other books, you know, because mm-hmm. they're still in the friend group or the family or whatever you're writing about. But like it seems like it's just a little easier to have more books than to come up with a reason for the person that you're writing about to do the same thing again. I don't know. Like it's,
I think it's like a different exercise because also you have to find a way to make them semi standalone. Mm-hmm. So that like, if someone picks up book 3, they're not like, who is everybody here? You know?
Yeah.
I don't know if I will succeed on that, but because I think a lot of it builds over the arcs. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really interesting because you have to be in a different person's head every book.
Yeah.
And so you're like mentally contorting yourself into a different way each time, and you mm-hmm. have to figure out how they tick. And there are like conventions too, where you have to like show people from previous books so that we can be reassured that they're still together and it's okay.
Yeah.
But not do it in a way that's super twee, where like everyone shows up and they're all coupled up and they're like, hi, we're still great. You know?
Yeah. I mean, I think the, you know, there is, I guess that's one of the potential potholes of romance writing is to not put too much of a bow on everything. Mm-hmm. Cause that's, I mean, you're guaranteed a happy ending. I mean, that's part of the romance genre, right? Whether it's happy ever after or happy for now. Mm-hmm. And I think that does make it a little harder not to paint yourself into that everything is perfect corner. But I don't know. I always joke that I want to write more romance, but too many people die when I write. So.
I mean, there's been a big resurgence in dark romance. So, you know,
I don't like to read it, which is weird. Yeah, it's not my thing.
It's not my thing either. I've had a lot of interesting conversations with other romance friends about why is it such a thing now and why is stalker romance such a thing now. And basically just speculating. I mean, if it makes you happy, it makes you happy. But mm-hmm. I find it like really hard to read super toxic relationships because I know a lot of people learn from these books.
Yeah.
You know, this is sex education for a lot of people. This is relationships education for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And so I find it disturbing when an author has a stalker romance and they don't earmark something as like, this is problematic. We have to deal with this at the end. Or like, mm-hmm. you know, you have these problematic consent situations and it's just sort of mowed over or treated as romantic. And it's like, can we stop for a second and like talk about this a little bit?
Yeah.
But
yeah. And that's usually like it, I can't suspend my disbelief, mm-hmm. I guess, when I read those and I'm just like, I'm out. So, but it's one of the things about your book that I appreciated is like when we get to the hot and heavy scene, I will not say who's involved in it. there's so much consent that's really sexy, like in the, in the actual encounter. And I'm just like, this is so well done. Like, I just like photocopy it and send it to people.
Thank you. I was really working on that. I wanted my sex scene to just have really good consent and still be hot, because I think it's possible. I really do.
Yeah, you know? No, I think you succeeded. And I think that's what it, like, it's, to me, it's always interesting, especially writing romance or erotica or anything like that. It's like, because writing about sex is hard. I think personally, I have a hard time not making it, like, it just always feels like, oh, how do I talk about this and not make it sound like squidgy? Or so what is that like for you, like sex scenes for you?
It's pretty hard, actually. It's something I have to like go back through a couple times and be like, is this actually sexy? And, you know, is this, you know, does this make sense? And there's like this balance of how anatomical you want to get and like how much you want to leave to imagination. That is sometimes hard. And then sometimes you have to do the thing in your head, like with fight scenes, where you're like, well, okay, where's the arm?
Yes.
But yeah, I think it's just a lot of trial and error, and like, and you read it until it's not hot anymore to you, and then you send it to someone else, and if they go, oh, that's hot, then you're like, okay, I got it.
Yeah. So I guess I probably should have asked this earlier, but did you always want to write romance, or did you have other ideas about what you wanted to write? Or
so I started in like sci-fi, urban fantasy. This was my not serious fluffy project, which promptly turned pretty not fluffy quickly, but it was like my sort of brainwash project, because I was like, oh, it's romance, it's not serious, you know, I did that thing. And all the other books that I wrote didn't quite work, but this one kept working, and I realized that I was mostly reading romance anyway, so why not just write romance, you know? What was I? And I think I was sort of, I had internalized that stigma a bit. And so I was eventually had to sort of push that out of my brain and just do the thing that I wanted to do.
Yeah. I mean, I think that stigma, it's hard not to internalize as a writer. Well, just as a femme person, it's hard not to internalize that. Cause I think part of why it gets shit on, because it's mostly women writing for women. And but I always like, and I love this. I recently listened to John Scalzi do a talk at the library here where they did an online thing. And even he said, hey, romance holds up the publishing industry. It's like half of all of, you know, publishing profits are coming from romance. Like it's the backbone of publishing, because people who read romance read voraciously. And, you know, that's why there's a lot of romance books. People read a lot of them. So, and I think we have come a long way on that, but
yeah,
it's still there
for sure. And like, I think, you know, if people aren't into romance, then they have, they're like, all they know is like the Harlequins or like the old Mills and Boons, the Clinch covers of the Fabio and stuff. And that's
the bodice rippers.
The bodice rippers. Oh my God. That's what my dad calls them. And that, like, as a teenager, he'd be like, oh, are you reading a bodice ripper? And I was like, I'm reading a YA book. Don't talk to me. You know? So I think that image is still very pervasive, but I agree. I think it's changing, and for the better. You know, we have all these romance bookstores, which are so cool. And like, you know, Steamy LitCon and all these various things. And I think a lot of it too is that it's becoming more diverse. Like, especially with, I mean, RWA is coming back, but they had this time when they went very dormant because they were dealing with a lot of those diversity issues, that they were still, you know, dominating Nazi romances for their awards and stuff like that. And I think there was this kind of reckoning that's still going on about that. And I think it's super important, because diversity needs to be reflected everywhere, but also it needs to be reflected in the genre that tells you you're good enough to be loved,
right?
You know, everybody is worth loving. And so they should be reflected in the love genre.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think what you said about diversity is really important too, because one of the things I think is great about new romance is there is so much diversity. Like the, you know, romance books with Black characters on the cover are not relegated to the Black romance section. I mean, probably it still happens, but it's mm-hmm. it's not the norm anymore, I think, to see that. And, you know, diverse authors are winning awards and being bestsellers and things like that in a way that I think is really impactful and powerful. And but I like that there's a lot of representation, not just like of I guess racial or ethnic diversity, but like also like you have a character in your book who has chronic pain, who's I think the main character, one of the main characters in the next book. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me, I think it's that, is it Get a Life, Chloe Brown, that she also has, yes. Like, and it was so good. And just mm-hmm. the way that like in that book that I can't think of the author's name. I can't think of the name
Polly
of the book. Thank you.
Polly Albert.
Yeah. That like it's just woven into the story and it affects things in the story, but it also gives the opportunity for characters to grow mm-hmm. in a way. Like it's not tangential. Like it's woven into the whole thing. And so, and I kind of like in your book, and when we meet that character, like it's commented on, it's a thing, but it's not who that person is. Like it's not the defining characteristic of that person in any way. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's something I'm working into book two, which is like sort of that disability rep, and that chronic pain is my chronic pain. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Judith, I gave it all to you. But, you know, I wanted to sort of represent that experience of sort of, and this is just like a tiny spoiler for book two, but she's like, she's broke and she has no insurance and she's in pain all the time and she doesn't know why. Mm-hmm. And like, that was me for a long time in my 20s. And so I sort of wanted to represent that and then maybe, you know, give some voice to that as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think just to be able to see yourself, whatever, you know, your identity is or whatever your reality is in a book is huge. Mm-hmm. And the more of that we get, the better, you know, with everyone writing more diverse characters and with own voices characters. And mm-hmm. like, I think it's just all important.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. And then if we could get the algorithms on board so they could stop suppressing folks, because that was a big issue. I went to StimulateCon last year and a lot of authors of color were talking about how if you just search on Amazon for whatever your keywords are, if you aren't specifically looking for authors of color, they get suppressed in those algorithms mm-hmm. And sort of not shadow banned, but like just pushed down the list a bit. Mm-hmm. And so we really have to, I don't know, put a little more effort in reading diversely, because you get so much more out of that. Like it's, I don't know, it's not just learning, but it's just a richness of experience. You know, yeah. We live 1,000 lives through books.
Yeah.
They shouldn't all be the same life.
No, exactly. I mean, I think that's, to me, that's the beauty of it. And the whole, like when you said marketing is hard and I'm thinking about the algorithms yeah. and just like, I mean, not that traditionally published authors don't have to do their own flogging, but I mean, it is mm-hmm. one of the things of being a self-published author or with a tiny press or any of those kind of mm-hmm. things that you're 100% your own marketing team. And it's really rough because you are fighting algorithms. You are fighting just the glut of stuff that's available, just like the attention span of humans and what we have available to us right now. You're fighting that too. So I think that part is really hard. And how do you not sell your soul while you're trying to sell your book?
So. Right. Yeah. Especially when I was just reading this book on influencers and like the search for authenticity and how it sort of became the norm to have the brand, like the brand of you, you know, that you're supposed to sell yourself along with whatever you're selling, or just being on Instagram as a person, you're supposed to sell yourself and brand yourself and be consistent in a way and show like a subset of your personality that's like not too perfect and authentic, but, you know, not the whole you, because that would be too messy.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, I mean, I think about like the weirdness of that, of like the brand mm-hmm. you, and like the weird parasocial relationships that come out of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, it's such a weird place to be right now. It's just a weird place to be. And I don't have solutions. It's just something I think about a lot. It's mm-hmm. like, how do we, you know, like I have this great writer group, and, you know, a lot of them are doing like the hardcore Facebook ads and Amazon ads and doing, you know, and I'm just like, I don't want to give them my money, you know, mm-hmm. like more. And I give them, you know, there's just no way really as an independent author not to be involved with Amazon, because you wouldn't make mm-hmm. you wouldn't sell any books. So it's just rough to think about how to navigate like your personal ethics and like the publishing industry.
Yeah. Yeah, it's still something that's sort of developing for me, is like, how much of myself do I put out there and who do I sell it to?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, you know, every time you post, or you like Empirical, you send a newsletter or whatever you do as marketing, it is a sort of soft sale. And I find that intersection a little fascinating. I mean, obviously I'm writing about fame and parasocial relationships, mm-hmm. and I find that interesting. But experiencing it then a little more firsthand is like, it's just a weird paradox.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. 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 And like I said, I don't have answers. I have a lot of questions.
Same.
Don't have answers yet. Yeah, it's and I don't know that answers can really be had. I think we all kind of have to navigate it the best that we can.
Mm-hmm.
But it is an interesting place to be. And I don't know, I do like that you write about parasocial relationships in the book. I mean, I think you know, there is kind of this whole subgenre of like rock star romances. Mm-hmm. And I think you've subverted it a little bit. So, which I really like. And I have to confess, I really want Benji's story. I hope he's in the line, or they're in the lineup for
book
one
three.
Of the books. Yeah, no, they were probably my favorite side character.
They are the scene stealer. So yeah, as you're not the first person to be like, Benji gets a book. And I'm like, yes, because Benji's book is going to be a lot of fun. I'm very excited. Well,
and plus they seem like, just with the history that we get in this book, they're really complex person, mm-hmm. like just a really complex person. And so I'm really curious to see what love looks like for them.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. I'm very excited for that pairing.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait. Well, like I said, I can't wait for book two. So now I can't wait for book three either.
Yay.
No pressure. It's the downside of writing slow and being a series author, is like people are like, where's the next book? And I'm like, oh no, I'm 5,000 words in. I'll tell you when I get there.
Right. Yeah. I'm like doing revisions and I'm like, should I do this faster? Can I do this faster? And the answer is no.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I have not figured out either real magic or CGI magic to make that happen.
I wish. If when you do, let me know.
Yeah. Oh, I'll be happy to pass it. I'll write a book about it.
Oh, there you go.
So for you, like what is your goal with writing? Like what do you really want to see happen?
So I kind of want to, like, there's a term for it and it's very silly, but it's called a celebrity. It's like when you're famous in a subculture. Mm-hmm. That's as far as I want to get. I want to be like in a niche and like people know me and my books and they're excited about it. And then like I sort of stay there. I don't ever want to get super big. Obviously writing about fame has changed me. No, I grew up in LA and I never wanted to be big. But yeah, I'd like to eventually not have to work full time while writing too. That would be really cool. Mm-hmm. I don't delude myself that I'm going to get anywhere close to supporting myself with my writing in the near future, but I'd like to maybe like work a little less.
Yeah.
And I want my books to reach people and make them happy and all that. So,
yeah.
You know.
No, I love manageable. That. Celebrity. I haven't heard that term, but I really like it. And I'm going to run with it. There's a great book, and I will put it in the show notes for people, but okay. It's called Creative Not Famous, The Small mm-hmm. Potatoes Manifesto.
Oh.
And it's from like an Erica's Press in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the editor of the book, whose name has escaped me because I have COVID brain right now, apparently, interviews a whole lot of different creative types, writers and artists and dancers and everybody about like what it means to create and not be famous. And like what that looks like and choosing and really choosing that rather than choosing to shoot for fame. And I don't know, it was just really for me, it was really kind of a way to look at what I was doing. I wish I'd had that term celebrity because I think that would have helped. Is that like I want the people who love my stuff to love it, but I know that it's not for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't write to market, you know, I don't do any of those things. And, you know, I have like a niche podcast, like writing about witchcraft, you know, even among witchcraft podcasts, we're pretty niche.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, yeah, like I get it. Like I kind of like being in my little, I guess, square peg hole.
Yeah. I got to check that book out because that sounds exactly like my jam.
Yeah, no, it was really helpful to read and just to listen to so many other creatives talk about, like, I do this because I love it, you know, mm-hmm. and yes, it's great to get paid. Don't get me wrong, mm-hmm. but it's not the, you know, the driving force of everything.
Yeah.
And I think a lot about that, that you can survive on, the 1,000 true fans theory. Mm-hmm. Like if you just have mm-hmm. 1,000 true fans, you can pretty much sustain yourself as a creative. I'm like, okay. So right now my newsletter's 800 people. I got to bump that up a little bit.
There you go. Yeah. But I totally agree, you know, and I, you know, I did the starving artist thing in my 20s and I don't want to do that again. You know, I'm 30 now. I don't want to, I have chronic pain. I don't want to go without health insurance. I don't mm-hmm. want to like be constantly stressed about money. So mm-hmm. I can't put that pressure on my artistic work anymore.
Yeah.
I can't expect to live off the scraps that people think writers should live off of.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really true. I had Margaret Kiljoy on a couple seasons ago and she talked about, you know, again, also had done the starving artist thing, you know, hop trains, did all that kind of stuff, lived rough and lived out of a van, you know, mm-hmm. all those things. It's like glorifying poverty isn't, that's not what art is about. That's mm-hmm. not what art should be about. It should be glorifying poverty. That's not what we want for anyone.
Right. Well, and the glorifying substance abuse and untreated mental illness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this idea that if you treat your trauma or your mental illness, you'll suddenly lose your muse. Mm-hmm. I think is very problematic because it sort of sticks people in these situations where they're like, yeah, I know I have issues, but if I treat them, I'm not deep anymore or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's like, no, but if you treat them, then you have perspective and you can look at it in a different way. And you can look at mm-hmm. it at a farther distance when you're not like constantly in fight or flight or whatever. And you can write about it better or you can art about it better.
Yeah.
And you can help someone else out of that hole.
Yeah, I had this like epiphany when I was in grad school. I was teaching like freshman comp class. And for like their final paper, I gave them a list of writers and said, you know, you have to write like read one of their books and write like a bio about them and like about the book that you read. And at one point, one of the young women who was in the front of the class, you know, she insisted on calling me Miss Victoria because it was Southern University. And I was like, please, it feels like kindergarten. Don't call me Miss Victoria. Mm-hmm. But, cause I told him not to call me Dr. Rashke because I wasn't. But she said, all of these people committed suicide or took their own lives. Every single mm-hmm. one of them, like maybe there was one or two that hadn't. And it didn't even occur to me when I made the list.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, you know what? You're right. if you find another writer you want to write about, just run it by me and we'll go with that. Because yeah, you shouldn't have to do this if that's going to be the story you have to tell.
Yeah.
And I was just like horrified that that was true. Like all of these writers I put on this list had taken their own lives. And then realized that also, like, also mostly as young people. So like, not only did they have untreated trauma, but we lost a whole lifetime of work, like a whole second part of their life. We lost all of that work that could have happened because.
Yeah. And it's that whole like live fast, die young thing. Mm-hmm. And this idea that you become less special as you age is like, it's so toxic, you know. It's just, you know, it's like ageism and all that wrapped up together. And and I think we could be better than that. You know, there's so many people who get more interesting as they age. I mean, some people stagnate in place. That's true. But some people get, you know, they stay open and they take in what's around them and they still have lots to contribute.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to focus on people who barely have their brains developed, you know, because your brain doesn't fully develop till you're 25. Like, why are we focusing on that? And why are we fawning over these people who are so young, you know, and warping them in our wants?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, one of the things I think about when I think about that is Brian May from Queen, weirdly. Like, you know, we lost Freddie Mercury far too young, and I can only imagine what he would have done had he lived. And then you have Brian May, who still makes music, but also has a PhD in astrophysics and, you know, helps put stuff on Mars. You know, like, to me, that's just amazing.
That's so cool. I didn't know that. That's really awesome. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he went back to school and got a PhD in astrophysics, and he worked on the Mars rover program.
Dang, that's really awesome.
Yeah, I think ageism does give us it steals a lot from us, I think. Honestly, I think it steals a lot.
Yeah My mom went back to school when I was in high school and got her PhD, and she like graduated like the same year that I did from high school with a PhD, and I just thought that was so cool. That's always stuck with me. And she faced a lot of ageism too, and because she went into academia and that's a whole thing, but you know, I think it was just so cool of her to do that, you know, as in her middle age, to just be like, I'm going to do it. I don't care. You know, I want to learn more.
Yeah. I mean, I've thought about it going back and getting my PhD. I'm 51, so I could probably do it. But the thought of spending the money makes me want to vomit.
Yeah.
And that's so fair. It's probably not going to happen just because I can't do it for free.
So. Yeah, she worked really hard. She like TA'd through it, and I think got financial aid and stuff.
Yeah, it's rough.
I couldn't do it. I don't even want to go get a master's at this point, because like, you know, I had my college debt. I finally paid it off. Yeah. I would like to not go into any more debt, please. Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. I will confess, like I paid off my undergraduate because I only had one semester I had to pay for, but I've been paying on my undergraduate debt since 99. It's the last century.
Yeah.
And because it was so old, I was eligible to have it forgiven.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So it was kind of life changing to get that email that was like, hey, by the way, because I owed more than I borrowed. I had been paying so long with such high interest, I owed more than I borrowed. And they were like, nope, you're done.
Wow.
I was like, holy crap.
I'm really glad that happened for you. It's so unconscionable to me that that's how the debt system works, that you can owe more than you borrowed.
Yeah.
You know, because you were too poor to pay it off immediately or whatever.
Yeah. So it was like, it was huge. And I've had a couple other friends who are my age who've had similar experiences. And because I think when the Biden administration's debt forgiveness thing got shot down, they really went after the how can we do this for people who are really, you know, who went to schools where their education wasn't worth it. I think they've done a lot within for-profit people who have debt with for-profit, and for people who have really long outstanding loans.
So those for-profit schools, man, such a scam.
Yeah. I have a whole story about that, but it's for another podcast. But like I said, my editor is probably laughing as I say this. We try to keep it to an hour. So before we do our game of chance question, would you like to tell people where to find your book and where to find you? This will come out kind of early summer.
Okay.
So our schedule is a little messed up right now because of the COVID bout. So I'm not sure exactly when it's going to come out.
Totally understandable. So I am at KataKissWrites on Instagram. You can also find my website, katakiss.com, and that's one S. And then my books are pretty much everywhere. My first book is pretty much everywhere right now. Hopefully my second book will be pretty much everywhere soon when this comes out, if not already. I'm trying to aim book two for summer because it's a summer book, but we shall see what life brings us. I'm not making any promises. I'm on the web. I'm on Instagram. I'm trying to keep it just to Instagram for now for my own sanity.
Yeah, no, it's wise. It's very wise. Cool. Well, I'll make sure all that's in the show notes for folks to find, and Creative Not Famous if people want to check it out.
Yeah.
And if I can remember, I will look up who the 1,000 fans thing is, and I will also put that in the notes because I talk about it a lot and I don't think I've ever put it in the notes. So we'll do that. Well, cool. So our last question, if you've listened to the episode, you know, it's a little game of chance. That a joke is part of my Scorpio nature. I really wanted to do a podcast just about these things, but somebody already does it. For NPR, of all things. I knew I couldn't compete. So this is how I get to do it a little bit. So I'll roll a die, and depending on what number I roll, you'll get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money. Mm-hmm. If I roll a 6, you get to pick which one you want. And you can say pass. There are really no rules to this game. So... 2, sex.
Oh, yeah, that was what I was hoping for.
Yay, we talked about this a little bit already, but so I guess kind of to build on what we talked about already. So what for you, where is your comfort limit for what you're willing to put on the page and why? Like how graphic, I guess, or how detailed maybe are you willing to be and why?
That's a good question. I think it depends what the story calls for. I don't know that I could write full erotica because I don't know that I'm that creative in the course of one story to get people in that many different sexual situations. And I do definitely have some kinks that are not for me, not to yuck anyone's yum, but like that I wouldn't be comfortable with writing about. But, you know, I think I could get pretty graphic if the story called for it. But then I would really have to warn my parents not to read my books. So, you know, I would probably put a big warning, like, if you're related to me, do not read this book. But, you know, I think it really depends what the story calls for. That said, I have not tried to put an erotica out in the world. So I might have a completely buried reaction that I don't know about.
Yeah, I haven't written that steamy, and I think that I don't write very steamy, and my sister has read my book and she goes, it made me blush, but it's because I know you. And I was like, okay, I mean, I guess that's fair, you do know me pretty well, and she also listens to the podcast, so she may find this very funny. Yeah, it's like for me, it's partly limited on, like you said, like, I don't know that I have enough creativity in that particular regard to make it interesting, like, and not just like, no pun intended or very intended blow by blow description. So yeah, it's, I don't know, it's just a challenge for me. And I kind of get to where, like, I'm like, I don't know. I guess in some ways, I'm, you know, as a writer, and I'm sure you've had this experience, people are like, oh, are you the character? Blah, 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 blah. And then when I think about that in terms of them thinking about the sex in the book, then I get weirded out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. Yeah. That's definitely something that goes through my head when I read my sex scenes. I'm like, oh no, is this too close to real life? Is this, will anyone else know?
Yeah.
You know, are they thinking that this is me?
Mm-hmm. And I always tell people, I mean, like, it came out of my head, but, you know, I've also, like, absorbed literally at this point 51 years of media. Like, it's not all just stuff I came up with on my own.
Right, yeah.
We're all doing a bit of a remix.
It's true.
So. Interesting stuff. Well, Kata, thank you so much for coming on, and thanks for reaching out. Like I said, I always want to tell people, like, you know, Kata contacted me and said, hey, I have this book. And I was like, yes, let's do it. So if you have a book you want to talk about, please get in touch with me. Get in touch with me on Instagram or on the website. And let's talk about your book. So, but thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was wonderful.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed it. And I think we got through mostly without coughing our heads off. So I'm proud of us.
I'm pretty proud of us too. I had a couple where I was like, don't do it. Don't do it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And I can't wait for book two. And maybe you should come back on and talk about book two.
Oh, maybe I will then. If Sounds you like- insist. All right. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shenankar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram and Threads at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.